Never succumb to beige and other tips for a colourful life is the title of the last book we'll talk about today on this morning of more books than usual on a Sunday. Interesting books they are. Frances Mannering is chair of the Orpheus Choir in Wellington, and she's co-owner and managing director of the creative agency Moxie. Frances also co-founded a tech startup, and she's had senior management and governance roles in four countries. She's originally from the Highlands of Scotland, where they succumbed to tartan, but not beige. And she was London-based for 14 years before moving to New Zealand. Kia ora, Frances. Very nice to talk to you.
Hello, Jim. Lovely to talk to you as well.
Quoting you, if you know your stuff, you can write a book. Even if you don't think you have anything special to say, you likely know more than you think, and your thinking and insights are different to anyone else's. I think that's on your website. That's true, of course, but in this age where everyone's sound or suspect opinions are widely aired, Frances, the question is whether people will want to read what you write.
I feel almost compelled to write. I have so many ideas rattling around in my head. If I don't capture them, you know, I start to feel a little bit unwired. But I think, do people want to read what you've read? I've been blogging for about 10 years. And although I don't have a huge following, you know, quite a lot of people actually really do enjoy what I write. I also think that I try to write. I mean, you know, we're in the middle of a sort of miasma. The whole world feels a bit disjointed and really a rather unpleasant place. And my aim in writing is to sort of see off some of the gloom.
I'm going to steal that word miasma and use it to apply to the state of the world. That's a good idea. Why do you say that writing a book is a great way of building confidence and self-belief? If you've ever suffered from imposter syndrome, and I certainly have on occasion, it's a great antidote. It's interesting you say that. I wonder if we all have imposter syndrome, you know, except for people whose diagnoses end with the letters P-A-T-H.
Yeah.
It's so common, and yet people conceal it big time, don't they?
Well, to me, it seems like everyone has insecurities. Everyone feels that they're not good enough. You know, there are always occasions when, I was just saying to someone the other day, I've spent my life questioning whether what I do is up to scratch. But at the end of the day, when you start looking at it and think, I have never tried to do something that I haven't been able to do, or I've never not been able to do anything I set out to do, I think the biggest problem is people just don't make the commitment to what it takes to make a book happen, which is consistency and just doing it regularly. And if you do that, you're already, it's a little bit like making your bed at the beginning of the day. You've already ticked one thing off the list. If you do some writing regularly, you can sort of pat yourself on the back and feel good about it, because suddenly you're thinking, yeah, I can't, I'm not that bad. I do know a few things here and there.
Never succumb to beige and other tips for a colourful life. And we're talking to Frances Mannering. Anyway, to cut the self-publishing story short, for the benefit of everyone listening who doesn't want to write a book, it's not actually an easy undertaking. I mean, you got up 2 hours earlier in the day and fitted the writing in that way, but the rest of it is no easy task either.
I think the funny thing is, I think the writing almost is the easy bit of it. But I, you know, my feeling was, I was really lucky because I made a decision, although I wanted to self-publish, and a lot of that was actually chronology. I've just turned 65 and I didn't really want to wait 3 years for a publisher to decide if they wanted to take my manuscript on. But I also did realise I needed a good team around me. You know, that whole concept in technology of build it and they'll come. Well, I think in writing or any creative project, people think I'll do it and, you know, it'll be so good people will just find it. And, you know, we know that's not true. So I found people around me. I found an incredibly good editor, funnily enough, after I'd asked around, someone I sing with. But I also found, I found a publicist. And that's something that makes a lot of difference, because it, you know, none of us have connections with media unless it's part of our job. I also found I wanted to do everything onshore, so I found an incredible book printing operation here who know everything there is to know about indie publishing. Your books were just amazing. And then I also decided to use a distributor for sales in New Zealand. And, you know, again, I think although you're giving away more and more and more, you know, slices of the pie, you're actually gaining, you know, a qualified expert team. And if you're going to achieve anything from it. I think that most people who set out on the indie trail don't know very much about it. And so, you know, bringing in professionals around the edges give you, I suppose, a fighting chance that you can make something with your creative energy.
Was this a phrase in your book, that your ship doesn't always come in, you've got to swim out to it?
I can't remember who said it, but I've loved it. It's been something I've, you know, believed in all my life.
So this is a book written by a woman in her 60s, as you say, but with a successful career still going strong. What sort of a career?
At the moment, I own a creative studio. We specialise in brand development and graphic design.
It's also a book written by a woman who went through hell after her long-term relationship to a well-known and successful man ended. You don't say why. Should I inquire?
Well, you can inquire. I think one of the things that, you know, one of the difficult things about being an author, someone's called my style confessional style writing. And I think you have to kind of figure out how much confession you're up for.
Yeah.
Because while I don't have any problem whatsoever, as you probably recognise, in talking my corner, I don't want to do any damage to anyone else.
Yeah, that's a fair enough answer. No, I understand that. I was just curious. Thought I'd ask. You often wear red. You say in the book, dress as you want to dress. And you quote Vivienne Westwood, who said you have a more interesting life if you wear impressive clothes. You obviously believe that.
Yeah, I do. I really do. I mean, if to me, clothes are like a prop. If you don't feel confident, you know, clothes and colour are a great way to actually pull yourself into the moment and, you know, put a self-expression across that you want to have. Potentially, it's attention grabbing, but equally, there's a sense of sort of self-worth about what you wear and turning yourself out well. And certainly, all the way through my life, people have often stopped and said, "I love what you're wearing. Where did you get it? You know, blah blah." A couple of people have asked me if I'd take them shopping, but actually, I've always resisted that. You know, I don't see myself as Trini or Susanna. And, you know, shopping for other people, I think my aesthetic is mine, not theirs. So, but I enjoy it hugely, and I still do. I don't spend a lot of money on clothes, but because I'm not a great brand collector, I like the things that I like, and I find them in all sorts of places.
So now we're getting into the meat of the book and the tips for a colourful life. Your outer layer shows signs of dishevelment, you say of yourself. But you always, I know that feeling, but you always carry a pair of rose-tinted glasses to look at the world through. How has that helped you?
I mean, in that chapter in the book, I talk about, you know, what you want to call it, whether it's your inner child, whether it's your inner goddess, warrior, whatever. Mine happens to be called Destriana, and which is a bit of a dream. But she is a person who I see as a sort of cross between Virginia Woolf meets Malibu Barbie meets, you know, Caitlin Moran. And she's, you know, we kind of have this person inside us, whether it's, you know, people call it their inner child. And some they are at probably the time we thought was our, you know, peak time. And mine sort of happily arrested herself at about 35, which I think is a great age. To me, that really makes a difference, having someone that reminds you of who you were as you age and what you have been and what you still are, because in essentially that person doesn't change. The inner person is who you really are, and that helps you, you know, keep a compass going for the future.
No, good advice. So Destriana's the 35-year-old who keeps you young, essentially.
That's the one.
She whispers in your ear. How hot you are as a woman dictates your fortunes in life. That's in your book, words to that effect. And then women become invisible. I think men do too now, although I agree not nearly as much while we males cling to the eroding vestiges of our power, fighting tooth and nail as we descend into equality. It's true, isn't it? I think you're probably right. And if we're telling the blunt truth, anatomy is destiny. You can see it in so many areas that better looking people get more media attention, for one thing.
Yeah. They tend to get more readily bank loans. They often get, you know, they often are advanced ahead of others. I mean, I think my comment there was that, you know, I certainly agree with you. I don't think that invisibility is something that's unique to women. It's that, you know, men experience it just as much. More happens that I'm probably writing more for women than I am for men. But a lot of men read my blog happily. So I'll take any audience that I can find, Jim. But I think with the invisibility thing, you know, this for men, there's the whole pale male and stale thing coming out, you know, which is quite difficult. And I do know people who've lost jobs, who've struggled to, you know, to actually find something else. So, you know, from 50s onwards, whether you're male, female or any gender, we're also in a world where if you don't succumb to cosmetic enhancement in some way, I mean, I certainly still continue to colour my hair, but I haven't succumbed to the rest of it. But I think we run the risk eventually where the people who are airbrushed and who are cosmetically enhanced will be a slightly, you know, a real advantage to anyone who hasn't done that. So the kind of new, old, young will be the people in, you know, who have primacy. The whole idea of never succumbing to beige, you know, very much the philosophy rather than the colour, is really saying we have to find who we are and find the value in who we are, and particularly as we age, because we can't allow societal norms to dictate what that should be. And I think we should stop making stupid jokes about senior moments and stuff like that and really, you know, just acknowledge we're people like everyone else.
I've never quite understood the enhancement effect. I mean, you see people who have too much collagen, you know, on their lips or something, and everybody knows that they're over-Botoxed or over-collagenized, whatever the verb is, and yet that gets a seal of approval, presumably because they've made an effort and they're in that tribe now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is, you know, people like to conceal it, but everybody knows what's being done and it's still successful for them.
I think, I mean, there's so many scales of it, though, Jim. I mean, if you think about Jane Fonda, she looks magnificent. And she's obviously, you know, she admits now to having had a lot of work done, which is a bit unfair because at the time she was having it, she didn't. And most people thought if you did enough aerobics, you'd end up looking like Jane Fonda. The sort of general look of, you know, people who've had the cosmetics, even the very best ones, start to look, you know, it's clear that they have. Some people look absolutely marvellous, but also you can watch them when they walk. If they're older people who look marvellous, they still have a little bit of a stiffness in their joints that they didn't have. And so, you know, it's not entirely possible to disguise everything. Now, they still die like the rest of us.
While we're on the topic, the same topic, Frances Mannering is with us, Never Succumb to Beige. Actually, better looking people have their share of big problems as well, which we don't need to delve into, but beauty can be a curse as well as a boon, especially in terms of insecurity and especially as you age. But, you know, there is no one happy remedy for how you look in life.
No. And I think, you know, a lot of it is very unfair if you don't, you know, if you don't start off with at least sort of reasonable attractiveness. But equally, I do think that you can learn to be an appealing personality. But I remember, this is a story I will never forget, someone I used to know in London. She looked very like Julie Christie. I mean, she was absolutely drop-dead beautiful. And she got stopped regularly on the street and asked if she would model something. We all thought she was in our group, and you'd find yourself staring at her, listening to her talk, and you'd stop listening to what she was saying because you were so mesmerised by how absolutely glorious she was. But she married someone who was ultimately what we thought was a really ordinary person. I mean, he was something like an antique dealer. We thought she'd, you know, end up with an A-lister or something. But her comment was, he was the first person that actually got to know me that took the time to see beyond how I look. Mm. And I think that's one of the, you know, I don't know many people that were really that beautiful. I met a few in London, but she was really outstanding. And she found it oppressive, you know. Obviously, there were aspects of it that she found really good. You know, as we said earlier, the benefits that accrue to people who are BPs. But that was an interesting commentary, and he was very nice, but he really was quite a straightforward, ordinary person, and she was just deeply grateful for that.
Yeah, that's a good anecdote. And one of your chapters is titled "Being In With the In Crowd." isn't all it's cracked up to be. And I think that's completely right, from having met many people whom society has exalted. But there is still something inside many, many, many people that propels them to make their lives larger, isn't there? They're not satisfied with what they've got. They've tried to make it better all the time and be in with the right crowd.
Well, you got me there. I want to be a best-selling author.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's face it. But I think, yeah, I think the problem is, you know, the world we live in now promotes the idea of, you know, the idol, the, you know, the Bake Off, the all the, you know, talent shows that there are, and they appear to be an easy route to, you know, wealth and success and fame. But I think that one of the problems that people don't really factor in, unless they've had people around them who've been good advisors, is that, you know, if you become that famous, every move you make, every time you move out of your house, somebody's there capturing the moment you don't want to have. If you are online and you say something out of line, you know, you're cancelled or you know, you're trolled endlessly. I mean, I don't think that that's a life many people would really choose, even though they'd like the trappings of it. But I suppose that, you know, in like many things, I mean, I've been, you know, involved in a tech startup. I don't think anyone would ever do that if they knew what it would take to get it up and running.
No, and there are only, in any field of endeavour, there are only certain stars. And a lot of the celeb stars are forgotten in 2.5 minutes now.
That's right.
That's the thing. Seize the day is one chapter. Because we don't know how many days we'll have, essentially. We somehow aren't wired to consistently seize the day and live in the moment, though. That's the truth for most people, isn't it?
Oh, sure. So I went back to the origins of the expression. And a lot of it's not really about... It's not... Horace didn't really mean never do anything more than live in the now. What his intention was, you know, try and shape the now so that you're not relying on a random future. And I think that's a better way of looking at it. I think the reality is that you want to not be so disturbed by being attached to the risks and, you know, pitfalls that might happen to you that you stop doing the good thing that you need to do today to make the future you want happen.
Yeah, no,
exactly. Does that make sense?
That makes entire sense. A laugh a day keeps the darkness at bay, which sounded like it come out of the Reader's Digest. You see this?
Oh, I don't aspire to those heady heights.
This sounds very solemn, and yet you say you've always been the one ready with a big smile and you're effervescent, and we can hear this in the conversation. Your book does start at this point, doesn't continue this way, but at this point to become a kind of way of surviving older age with a spring in your step.
Well, I suppose I didn't really set out to do that. I mean, my concept of swing in the step is really intended to be for every age. I mean, you know, I love young people. I think about my great niece and nephew. I'd love them to think that, you know, the whole process of growing older isn't a scary graveyard where, you know, you just go to become a sort of, you know, a hulk that does nothing. You know, I'd like people to believe that there is still time, you know, that the whole, I finished it up with, it's never too late to be who you might have been.
Diamonds aren't a girl's best friend. What are?
Oh, darling, your teeth.
Teeth, yes, there's a chapter on teeth.
Yeah, I would say investing in your teeth is one of the biggest things you can do to stay colourful. Because, you know, in the old days, they used to take people, you know, they used to remove teeth at will instead of trying to repair them. But, you know, we can do as much as we can to look after them. And when you think about how someone smiles, you know, the teeth do make a big impression.
Why does no one tell us when we are young about teeth? It would be... I liked this chapter. I mean, well, I liked a number of your chapters, but it would be a more valuable part of the syllabus than, you know, the economic geography of the Ruhr district in Germany, which is a question I remember from school certificate when we all had to sit it. You know, we don't get told about a lot of things when we are young that are absolutely crucial to life, success and enjoyment.
I wonder, yeah, exactly. When I was a kid, way back in the midst of time in the Highlands of Scotland, there was a public campaign that, I won't sing the jingle because I'll embarrass myself, but there was a little, there was a public health campaign that went around, and the jingle went, brush your teeth last thing at night, no more food and just sleep tight. Then you'll wake up fresh and bright with a happy smile. And but, you know, as a kid, and we all got stuck, you know, we had an earworm of the jingle, and they came around the schools and gave us sort of free, you know, toothbrushes and stuff. But it stuck, you know, obviously it stuck with me all these years later. And I think that as a kid, you take it on a different level. But I don't think it's like trying to teach children how to budget, you know, or not to take a student loan out, because imagine the complications you're going to give yourself later on. I don't think kids at a certain age, they hear you, they yes. understand, but I don't think they know how to apply it.
No, and maybe if you just took them 40, 50 years into the future and said, this is you then.
Yes.
This is you in 40, 50 years' time if you don't listen to what I'm saying now.
Yes. maybe that would be one of the good uses of AI.
That's a very good notion. You mentioned singing. Tell us about your singing. There's a chapter called Sing Long and Prosper.
Well, I grew up, as I said, I've mentioned a couple of times, I grew up in the Highlands of Scotland. My grandfather, too long a story to go into, but he bought a big hotel in the Highlands, big old Victorian mausoleum. But it had a big ballroom. And at that stage, you know, we had endless bus parties of English tourists coming up to the Highlands. And so my dad was a singer. And I grew up, you know, knowing the sort of Scottish, the Scottish folk music tradition. He was marvellous. He knew everything. He had been trained to sing. And so I've always loved singing. We were a little bit like, my maiden name is Patterson, and we were a bit like the Von Patterson family singers. We sang everywhere, you know, in the car going places. You know, it's just before, you know, there were only about one TV channel that stopped at about 10 o'clock at night. And so, you know, singing was a big part of our repertoire. And all of my family, both my mum and my dad's family, were musical. So I sing with the Orpheus Choir Wellington. I also chair its board. And, you know, that which is a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. It's a big love for me. And so being able to help shape the choir's success is very fulfilling.
Yeah, there's a bit about the Orpheus Choir in your book. Never Succumb to Beige is the book, and other tips for a colourful life by Frances Mannering. My last question, New Zealand, just finally, was a beige country once upon a time, which had actually many advantages as well as disadvantages. We had decent infrastructure and people were far better behaved. There was only about one murder a year. And we're certainly less beige now, and many people are thankful for it. But beige has its place, arguably.
Beige has its place, of course it does. I think it just can't be predominantly beige. And, you know, to be absolutely clear, I have no problem about people wearing beige, taupe, or neutral clothes, or having interiors that are largely those colours. I think it's just a metaphor for being alive, being strongly alive. And I think New Zealand's always had a sort of force about it. When I was a kid, I mean, Dad was really into rugby, and we were, as quite little kids, we were allowed to stay up and watch the test matches on TV. And I can just remember being in absolute awe of the All Blacks, you know, the whole haka, you know, which was very exotic to us in our little Highland fastness. I also, you know, when I was at university, they came and toured and came and partied at St Andrews a couple of times. But I think, you know, New Zealand's not been without colour, not at all. It's been perhaps more morally, you know, it's been perceived as morally upright. I don't know whether I would describe that as beige. I think it has an authenticity about it that has its own colour.
Yeah, fair answer. Frances, thank you very much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Lovely to talk to you, Jim.